Welcome back for another week of the Get Hip Cast. This week, our episode's entitled Buffer Overflow 706, bunch of hexadecimal codes. You can convert those to hex to ASCII and see exactly what it means. But I'll tell you, we're going to talk a little bit about passion today. And we're going to start with, for those of you who tuned in last week, you know, this podcast is all about the intersection of culture and technology. And there's lots of things going on in the world socially. We have presidential election coming up. We got lots of things going on, lots of great content to talk about. And we've all been stuck in our homes and 6+ feet, hopefully, away from other people for the past 6 months. So that's changed our working environment. And it's given a great talk track around, you know, culture and technology and how those two things meld together. So let's get started with introducing our guest today. We have Michelle Nizad. I'll ask her to introduce herself in a minute, and Harvey Villegas, both members of my team, and both have similar but different roles, and both come from actually pretty parallel backgrounds, and I'll let them expand on that a little bit. Michelle, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. I'm Michelle Nizad. I've worked with Rich over the last 7.5 years. This was actually I started working with him right out of college. So a lot of my career has been under Rich and learning under Rich's guidance and with his team. I've held a few different hats or worn a few different hats over the years. I started off more technical on the engineering side, and I've slowly kind of melded into more of a program management, process management role with the team. I work a lot with customers directly, a lot of expectation settings. So I've kind of been in on both sides, both technical side and the process management side and program management side. So I have a little bit of a unique background as far as what I do with customers. Other than that, from a personal standpoint, I live in New Jersey, and on weekends right now, out of quarantine, I have been trying to get outdoors as much as possible. So I've been trying to get down to the beach and just get out of the house a little since going into the office has no longer been an option these days.
Thanks, Michelle. Harvey.
So, guys, I'm Harvey Villegas. I started working here 5 years ago. I started working under Rich, but I'm always moving around at first. Recently, I've just been working a lot of the technical roles, in addition to also helping some new hire members get accustomed to our work style and how we interact with our customers and how we do the technical side of things. Basically, we do a lot of post-sales, technical issues, troubleshooting, maintaining infrastructures, constantly communicating with the customer, making sure everything's going well with them, that all the technology is working as intended. And as more personal things, I've just been trying to get out to the park more. I'm pretty excited that gym's about to open, but a little worried as well. I know they're opening soon, like the next week or two. So just basically just going through life with this whole COVID thing going on. But everything's been going well so far.
All right, thanks, Harv. So for those who tuned in last week, everyone knows the one thing we won't talk about on this podcast is the new normal, because kind of what's wrong with, in my mind, a lot of what's wrong with our culture and society has to do with definitions of what's normal and not normal. So let's just call it what is, as opposed to what's normal and what's not normal. So as we dig into this, there were a couple things that popped up this week that I thought we'd start off with. So one of them was somebody shared a podcast with me as a result of last week's podcast on from the guy who founded Ruby on Rails, the developer who developed that programming language. And there was a lot of discussion in the podcast about the 40-hour work week and the, you know, knocking down startup culture and the thought that you need to work an 80+ hour work week in order to start a startup. And this gentleman was hypothesizing that that's not reality. It's not true. You can work a 40-hour work week and still have a startup and be successful. And his perspective was, I did it, so it's possible. So I watched we're getting to the opinion piece in a minute. I watched the podcast, and I think there's always some danger in listening to someone who started, someone who incubated a startup company that's heavily tech focused, like, hey, I wrote a programming language, I open sourced it, I gave it to the world for free, or I'm Linus Torvalds and I wrote Linux, or I'm Jeff Bezos and every morning I hang out with my kids for an hour and I wrote this article on it. I think the peril there is that if you're the type of person who jumps in with 2 feet to write a programming language and release it to the world, you're probably not working 40 hours a week. You may think you're only working 40 hours a week, but you're obviously pretty passionate about that thing that you're doing, which makes probably a lot of what you're doing not feel like work. So my question for you is, both of you have been in tech for a little while, like, how important do you think passion is when it comes to, you know, the difference between delivering a good work product and a great work product? Michelle, we'll start with you.
I think passion's huge. I think, honestly, without passion, it's really hard to have a solid deliverable at the end, whether it be services, whether it be the product, or whatever it may be. I think that without passion, you can clearly tell that there's something missing in the deliverable. And so for me, when I first got into it, I think I kind of struggled finding that right, that passion. And over the years, I've found different avenues for passion that might be different from what motivates other people on my team or other people in the company. But I think I finally have found that drive. And I think that it shows in a lot of the work that I have and a lot of the relationships I have with not only customers, but also internal with my team, because I think it is reflected in the work that I'm doing.
Thanks, Michelle. How about you, Harv?
Yeah, for sure. Passion is definitely an important part. It's definitely an important part of culture as well. I know we're going to go into that a little later, but to have passion, it means a lot, because that's what really motivates you, what gets you going, what makes you go the 110% rather than just hitting the status quo. And for myself, it's kind of similar to Michelle. At first, it was kind of hard to find the passion. You know, I wasn't too familiar with this data center industry. So at first, it was just a lot of black and white for me. But the more I start getting into it, the more I realize that it's more of how you view things. So it's if you want to view things more intricate and more full of passion, then that's how you have to take upon yourself to start looking at things differently. One little thing, I saw a little TED talk that said try to make things like a video game. So what I do is, like, sometimes I'll try to be like, oh, I did this last time in an hour. Let me try to see if I could do it more efficiently. Or, I was able to complete A, B, and C, but let me see if I'm able to try to do some automating tasks, or just try to take things more in of like an exciting manner than just being like the status quo about just tackling problems and issues.
I like that idea. You gamifying your life.
Yeah.
Very
try
cool.
Yes, I can.
Okay, cool. Good. Great segue. So throughout quarantine, over the last 5-6 months, you know, as we've all been working from home, some of us obviously have easier time, harder time, and for lots of different reasons. Has it been easier or harder to motivate yourself, and why? Michelle, I'll start with you.
So definitely in the beginning of quarantine, it was definitely harder for me to motivate myself. I think I had gotten used to a cadence of going in the office, seeing people, and that kind of being my motivation to get up and get going each day. And so having that kind of ripped apart, and then also I think in general, I'm just a very social person. So I live in a city. So a lot of that was taken away from me on my day to day. So I think that kind of hit me hard. I also live with roommates. That's also like a struggle. All of a sudden the three of us being home all the time. But over time I definitely was able to adjust and make certain adjustments in the way I work, where I work, and then limiting hours of when I can work and really being able to like shut down. I think for a while I was maybe overcompensating and then working too much, and then I would get burnt out real fast in the beginning. And so now I've had that balance where it's like, no, like you can take an hour long walk in the middle of the day because I'm getting my work done, and kind of like reset and then like finish the day all strong. So it took a little bit of adjusting, I would say, but I think I finally found a way to motivate myself on a daily basis now, a more consistent basis at least.
That's great. Great tips. How about you, Harvey?
Yeah, I got to take your tips, Michelle. So yeah, at first, At first, I didn't notice much of a difference because, like, we've been working from home for some time. We've been doing the collaboration through Slack and through other applications. So it wasn't much of a change. I would tell my friends, you know, it's like the same old thing for me. But the more things started ramping up, the more like COVID actually got real, where there's a lot more deaths, or it started inciting riots or some other things with police brutality, a lot of things going on. I started felt like it did take away a little bit from my motivation, just because like you're over here working on like backups, but you have like so much more things going on in the world. So it's kind of like that like thought kept piercing into me. But the more I got into it, I guess you kind of get used to it. You kind of like learn how to adjust. And then I was just thinking about how many people are like without jobs or struggling right now, and how I'm fortunate and lucky to have this position. So that kind of like increased my motivation a lot, just wanting to just be on top, be well, provide for my family and friends as much as I can. So I've definitely gone through ups and downs of motivation throughout this COVID. But right now I feel like I'm starting to get used to this work style, this new I don't know if you say the new norm, but it's so the old norm, which just became a bigger norm. For us at least. So I've been just a little bit better with motivation lately, just trying to be more positive about things. So that's been helping me a lot.
Thanks, Harv.
Harvey, I think your point about thinking about other people who are struggling in different industries and being lucky to have the jobs we do have and being able to have that each day is definitely a good way of looking at it. It helps definitely motivation on a daily basis.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, we just a maybe a different perspective, because I agree. It's, you know, there's a lot of really big stuff going on. It's like we're not exactly saving lives. You know, some people like to take, some people make a stretch and, you know, say we're saving lives. But let's face it, we're not saving lives. But I do think I do. Sometimes I sit back and I think about the value of keeping your eye on the ball and what it delivers. And if you think about it, just, and sometimes like when you get too big of a macro view, it's hard because you feel so powerless, right? You've got all this stuff going on and you have such little influence over it that it can get overwhelming. So I think about it like this, like, you know, thankfully everyone kept their eye on the ball. Our business did pretty well during the pandemic and, you know, social unrest and all everything else going on in the world. We've managed to chug along and do pretty well. I think some of that last week we talked a little about, I think some of the training our team has had around just working geographically dispersed, learning how to use our communication tools like Slack and, you know, video conferencing, and how to sit on a video conference for, you know, 5, 6, 7 hours and be able to do it and make it an enjoyable experience, as opposed to something that's just like, oh, this is horrible. I got to go to my office all by myself. Instead of like, there is a way to like still create human contact and get to know people. So I think that's positive. And I think ultimately because our business has done well, we were able to create, you know, we have a 30 person team. We were able to create, you know, grow our team by 30% during a pandemic. You know, we hired 7 people during a pandemic. That's pretty cool. While the rest of the world is kind of, you know, reducing their workforce, we're growing our workforce. And a lot of that's just because, you know, we're all able to keep our eye on the ball. And I think we can affect more change than we think. And a lot of it is within our control, if we don't get dragged down by a lot of stuff going on in the world. So I think a good proof point to say, hey, listen, we did make a difference. We gave 7 people jobs. Maybe we wouldn't have had jobs otherwise.
Yeah, that's huge.
All right. So next question. And I'm trying to think about how to phrase this question because it's one that just popped up. But as we're working from home, you know, and last week I think we talked about this a little bit, there's this fine line between creating usability friction and forcing workarounds in workplace tech. So, you know, we have a need and a desire to secure our platforms and do all these things. But, you know, I'm always trying to figure out what is the tipping point where you've created such a platform that's so hard to navigate and accomplish anything within that everything you do is a workaround. And how much does that diminish value? And do enterprises care, or are they just looking to check the box around, hey, we have a security protocol. It's enforced. Here's how it's enforced. Yeah, okay. 90% of the workforce is working around that protocol because they kind of have to, but we're like clean in the process because we created a protocol. Harv, we'll start with you. What do you think about that in terms of productivity, how much time you spend working outside the system versus working inside the system? And are people really listening? Or are they just saying, hey, no, we need to lock it down?
So yeah, I've had a couple thoughts on this. I know that we've had some new systems where we take care of our ticketing, of our tracking of changes, and so a whole bunch of our just like main infrastructure and assisting customers. And the more we grow, the more complex systems we get, the more checkboxes we need to cross, the more certifications, and the more types of security validations that we need in order to continue getting more clients, bigger clients. And I think there is a balance you have to strike, because if it gets too complex and people aren't going to want to use it. I know I've had I've had a talk with a couple coworkers where they say it's a little too complex sometimes. The customer thinks the customer doesn't want to use it as much because it's just a new system, requires a lot more checking the box of going in tickets, going in through other portals, making sure you're double authenticated, making sure you have these apps that authenticate you, or a whole bunch of different more aspects that didn't involve before when we had a simpler system. So I think there's definitely a balance where that you have to strike, it's getting that right security and also making that right usability for the user to make it easy for them to use. Because if it's too secure, if it's too much complex systems involved, they're not going to want to use it, and they're going to find workarounds. So I've definitely seen that in my work culture. I feel like we're constantly striving to get like a good balance of that. And I think the good companies want to get a good balance of that instead of just checking off boxes.
Thanks, Harvey. How about you, Michelle?
I agree to an extent that there are definitely some just processes that get put in place to check off boxes. I definitely see the benefit of some of them. At the end of the day, we do handle customer data, customer information. We want to be able to protect that. We want to say that we're protecting that, not only internally, but externally to our customers. So I definitely think there's a need to an extent. I feel like I was personally victimized over the last couple months building in some new processes, having to rebuild my computer and things like that, that have definitely hindered my productivity over, certain periods of time. I do know that that's an adjustment period, and that will eventually even out, and that won't be an issue in the long run. And a lot of it is just getting used to some of the process. So there's always a lot of complaining in the beginning, right? And then eventually it kind of evens out. And also you get feedback, and then you adjust, and then you there's another change period and whatnot. So I definitely think that sometimes there's an over rotation on it to just check a box off. But at the end of the day, security is huge, right? People get hacked, companies get hacked all the time. So there's definitely a certain level that needs to happen. But when it starts, when that change period takes longer and longer to get adjusted to new protocols or processes, and or it, the new normal is, this step is going to take you an extra 10 minutes every day to do X, it does start to hinder part of the business. So you want to be able to avoid that, or at least accommodate it to a certain extent. So I do think certain areas there's pushback, and then, in certain areas it makes sense.
Yeah, it's definitely a complex problem. I remember I took this Coursera class on usable security, and they gave an example in the class about little crash carts they have in like hospitals. Like when the doctor comes into your office, they log into a little cart and it's got a computer on it. Mm-hmm. There was a company that was because that's there was patient information. It's protected by HIPAA, and they hired a consulting company to come in and figure out how to secure those systems more so than a password, because people would log in with their password. Their password, wasn't necessarily secure. It was under a mat or like look underneath the keyboard and there's the password. And they'd log in and then they'd walk away and not log out. And the system would time out after 15 minutes or so. But, there was exposure. So the company came in and they put proximity sensors on all the systems. And so once the doctor or nurse walked, more than 5 feet from the crash cart, the system locked up. Well, they got annoyed because the doctors and nurses got annoyed because they like go to the patient's bed, then they come back and be locked again. They go to the patient's bed, they come back. It was like being locked too much. So they took a styrofoam cup and stuck it over top of the proximity sensor and a piece of technology that was meant to secure the system more was totally thwarted by a styrofoam cup. So every system they found was unlocked, and it was basically like no one considered the user experience when they were designing that security control. And the fact that, you know, the doctors and nurses were moving 10, 15 feet from the cart, and then they'd come right back, and it just got annoying. So it actually ended up being creating a bigger gap in the process than what existed before. And I just thought it was an interesting case study.
User acceptance and testing is so big, especially around new processes that are added, simply because it gets too difficult to, you need that feedback, right? Because the person designing it isn't the one actually doing the day-to-day work. And you have to make sure that, you know, you guys are aligned at some point in that process, or else you're going to get scenarios like that. And I can think of a few like scenarios like in our company that, you know, and processes that we do, and we, you know, you end up making a workaround, and half the time you don't know it until it's like brought to your attention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, cool. All right. Now let's go to the techie side a little bit. So for those who don't know, every year we usually do our team does a kickoff or retreat, whatever you want to call it. And we usually have some kind of project intended to kind of be a passionate project. And we've done individual projects and team projects, and they've kind of run the gamut. And we're lucky enough to have two winners on the call this week. Different years, but two winners, an individual project and a team project. And what's interesting is they both delivered great products, different styles, and I thought it'd be cool to talk about it. I happen to have the year that Harvey won, we built these self-driving cars, and normally I'll kind of do the project either in parallel. So this is what the car looks like. I don't know if Harvey has his there, but he can do a little show and tell if he wants. So Harvey did a team project where he made a 1/16th self-driving car. And Michelle did one, I think, the previous year where she built a Scooby snack dispenser, which maybe if she has it, she'll show it to you. But what I thought was cool, it was, you know, fabricate the hardware, code it, et cetera, et cetera. And I thought it'd be cool for both Harvey and Michelle to tell us a little bit about the projects, kind of the process they went through. I think it was the first, Michelle, you were the first year I think we did a project like that, right? And then Harvey definitely had a brute force approach, which was just like refuse to lose approach, which I thought was cool. And he, maybe you can tell us. So Michelle, we'll start with you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this, the thought process and the thought process of the Scooby snack dispenser.
Yeah. So, I will correct you in that it was called Stu's Chews. I have an adorable little dog named Stuart. So it was a fitting name for the project. And we basically had free reign to do what we wanted. We had to incorporate a Raspberry Pi to do, put some kind of code on it to do something useful in your life. So, there were a lot of variations of what we ended up doing. But I ended up, deciding what could actually help my day-to-day life. And at the time I was going to the office quite frequently, and I had seen some of the automatic dog feeders, and I thought, you know what, how hard could it be to like code something not super complex where it's going to shoot treats out or anything, but something that I could sit on top of my dog's cage, and you know, every so often I could have it kind of dispense a treat. So I ended up doing a lot of research and tapping into a few resources internally on the team, at some different coworkers helping me, and ended up coding a auto, I don't have it anymore. It's at my parents' house right now, or else I would have had it to show you. I ended up taking a plant vase, kind of. What's the word I'm looking for?
Like a plastic planter?
Yeah, a plastic planter. And I ended up cutting it up. So turned it upside down, cut a hole in it so the treat could drop out. And then I created like a little like windmill on the top that would rotate whenever I either initiated it from the Raspberry Pi or automatically every so often. And it would just drop, it would like rotate the little windmill around and it would drop the treat down into the cage. So it was kind of cool for me because on the coding side of things, I was pretty green on that side of the industry. So it was a fun learning experience. At first, I got super frustrated and I was like, this is never going to work. And by the end of it, I was, you know, running to Home Depot to get, you know, get actual products to put something together so I could actually have a demonstration for people at the kickoff. And I really got into it. I at first was just, you know, I just needed to rotate. And then it was, no, I can do more than that. I can put it on a schedule. I could do it so that like I could, you know, automate it to happen every, you know, 3 hours, or I could send a, you know, eventually my idea was like to send them, you know, send it, you know, a Slack notification and trigger it to rotate if I was in the office or something like that. But yeah, that was at a, in summary, that was the project I did. It was a lot of, you know, at first I was like, oh, so much time to put into this. I don't even know how to code. I don't know where to start. And then once I got the idea, I got like, I really got excited about it. I put a lot of time into it. And clearly I think that's where it kind of shifted from just like a task that my boss was giving me to like an actual, like, I'm really excited to do this. This is like now what I'm doing on the weekends. And I got to incorporate, I'm big on my personal life. I love to like recreate furniture, paint. So I kind of got to put two different worlds together in one project. And I think the end result was actually pretty cool. I wish I had it here to show you guys. But unfortunately I do not.
Yeah, I have it in a video. So I'll put the, yeah. I'll put the YouTube link to the YouTube video in the show notes and that to that point in the video where you can take a look at Stu's Choose in action. it was a great project. And I thought it was really cool how you did the fabrication tied to the servo and then the Raspberry Pi. It was just it was a really good end to end project. And I'm glad you ended up enjoying it. Yeah. Harvey, tell us a little bit about your project.
So yeah, our project was to make a 1/16 automated car. So we basically got a RC car. We attached a Raspberry Pi to it. Did I disappear?
Yeah, you can't really see it with the background.
Yeah, so we got an RC car, and then we attached a Raspberry Pi to it, attached the battery, and then basically we were just trying to make it self-learn or just drive it around until it's self-learning how the road looks or how the lines on the streets look. Until it's able to drive by itself. Just a lot of training, a lot of coding on the Raspberry Pi, making sure all these Raspberry Pi Linux tools work right. Everything's all working on the same versions, a lot of troubleshooting. But yeah, basically, once we started getting it going, just like Michelle said, at first, it kind of seemed like, you know, I'll do this later. We have other things going on. And at first, it was like a slow start as well. You know, teams will get like something small accomplished. Oh, we downloaded the tools we need. Okay, let's go on next week. But then as like the pressure started building up, as we start getting more involved in this project, I think all of us got a little more involved, a little more passionate about it. I could tell even members that, you know, at first didn't really contribute too much, at the end were contributing a lot more. I think a lot of it is also pressure. I remember one of my other colleagues was talking about how pressure helps them do a lot of work. I agree with that too. Maybe it's not the best of habits sometimes, but at least for us, it kind of helped us out a little bit. Especially at the end. At the end, I felt like I needed to just be a lot more stricter. So I guess that's where you got the brute force. I just started trying to, at the end, we were spending a lot more hours in comparison to how we were doing at the beginning. And we were just trying to try different methods. At one point, our car actually, we downloaded some wrong versions of tools. And for the life of us, we couldn't get it to work. So we had to completely start all over. I mean, erase our project and do it all over. And yeah, basically just getting more involved in it, getting the teammate more involved, getting just more accustomed to what we're doing and understanding it better. It just helped us grow along the way for this project, at least.
Yeah, you probably learned a lot about the fragility of the machine learning stack.
Yeah.
Cool. With those answers in mind, like when you think about the projects, and we've done lots of projects over the years, and they haven't all been technical in nature. Some of them have been presentation skills or just kind of just, you know, trying to take something that will help us at, you know, do a better job or learn something, but also try to make it fun. What sort of impact do you think those activities have kind of had on your professional development? Harv, we'll start with you, since we started with Michelle last time.
So yeah, so I really enjoyed this project, honestly, and I was trying to compare it to the other projects I did throughout here and throughout my college career. And I just never was as passionate as I was with this one. I guess because this one was a little bit more fun. Like other college projects are just, they stick to your course. This was a little different for us from what we do every day. Basically, this has allowed us to be more creative, to work together, be more collaborative, and just try to find each other's strengths and weaknesses in our team and try to allocate these different jobs amongst each other's. So just working with the team, it made me really connect with some of my team members more. It taught me some valuable leadership skills. And basically, I don't know, just being more involved. And just it's cool driving an automated car. It's just a cool concept, especially now with like Tesla and all these other companies growing up, getting big. It was just a really cool project. And it just really helped me grow and help our team relationships as well.
Great. Thanks, Rob. How about you, Michelle?
So when I won, it was an individual project, but I definitely learned a lot about myself. And also I did end up tapping into a lot of people, actually no one from our team directly. It was people from outside the team that I work with. So I got to get close to coworkers in a way that I hadn't before because it was a personal project. It was over a long period of time. And so I kind of got to connect with a few different members from the company in different ways, which I thought was huge, which has actually led to stronger relationships, which with actual customer projects has helped me, be able to tap into them in an easier and a more personal way. I've been around for 7 years, so I've done a bunch of these projects. So I've done a lot of the teamwork projects and individual projects as well. And I think at the end of the day, the technology is fun, and that obviously is like one of the key aspects of the project. But at the end of the day, it does make the team stronger, I think, in various ways. But one of them is just getting to know people more personally. For the project, I was actually on the competing team of Harvey for the race car project. I ended up hosting a lot of the meetups at my apartment. We'd end up actually hanging out after, having a few beers, drinking some beers and eating dinner. So I think when you can start to make the people that you work with on a day-to-day basis a little bit more personal, actually connect with them on a little bit more of a personal level, that's always going to benefit you professionally. And it's, you get to see people work in a different manner. And, I think that's always helpful at the end of the day.
Great feedback. So, all right. So that gets us to really one of my favorite questions for this week, which is having both worked on teams in different and led teams in different facets, right? Harvey, you led the autonomous car vehicle team. Michelle, you led we did a solve it day, and you led a team in the solve it day. I think you played kind of a vice president role in the autonomous vehicle challenge project. Having been on teams and led teams, how important is it to nurture a culture on the team, and how detrimental is it when someone on that team doesn't want to be part of the bigger culture, or people haven't learned to, like, whether you're a leader or a member of the team, right? Like, there's lots that's said about, being a good leader is learning to be a good follower. And you can't really be a good leader until you're a good follower, because ultimately, in order to build a culture, everybody has to follow, right? Because you're really following the culture. The leader might just be shepherding the culture, but the culture is it's a living thing. It's not a defined destination. It's a living thing that will change day in and day out. And I think we're seeing that now, right? We're seeing things happening in society, the human condition, changing cultures rapidly. And I think we're seeing some organizations which are built around, the ability to pivot their culture and change, because the culture really is about the people. So the culture will adapt to the people. And then I think we're seeing other organizations that are saying, this is our culture. Like, we just have to get back to our culture. Like, things are all messed up because we're not adhering to the culture. But the culture follows the people. The people don't follow the culture. So to me, it's like, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about that because I think there's a massive shift happening around where will good people work in the future and where won't they work and why will they work there? And I think a lot of companies have learned whatever their culture was. They've certainly, my neighbor was over yesterday and she's a, she works for the court system. She's a, like a, I think she's a psychologist. And so she has to show up at hearings. And normally she works at the courthouse. The courthouse has been closed. And she was showing me like Zoom calls. Here's the judge. Here's the defense attorney. Here's, you know, here's the prosecutor. Here's the defendant. The defendant's sitting in the jail. The judge is sitting at their house and they're all on a Zoom call and they're trying cases and sentencing cases over Zoom. And she's like, you know, and she happens to be a social person. She's like, you know, I really miss like going to lunch. She's like, but I don't miss like having to sign into the courthouse, sign out of the courthouse when I go out for a walk. Like I don't miss that cultural aspect, which was like, no one would have ever thought you could have tried cases on a Zoom call. But now here they are 6 months in, court system's still moving. Arguably it's probably moving faster than it was before because they don't have all the logistical issues of people getting to places. So I found that really interesting just in a different, you know, work stream than tech, because tech, I think it seems pretty easy to work remotely in general, if you're not manufacturing something. But what I want your opinion on is how important is, you know, that need and willingness to nurture a culture that is like ever evolving, and how detrimental is it when people don't want to buy into the culture, whether it's leadership or, you know, members of the team. Michelle, we'll start with you.
I think, I'll probably start sounding like a broken record at some point. I think culture is huge, and I think that adoption of culture is huge as well. And I do agree with the concept that culture follows the people. And you know, obviously, this has been a huge evolution in anyone's culture for any company, just given the current state of the world right now. So there's, you know, we're definitely in a shift and an adjustment period. But I think it's huge to have people, you know, actively adopting the culture and participating in the culture. And when you have, you know, a few people who like choose to, you know, stand against it or think that that's not the right path to go down and actively avoid that culture, it's pretty detrimental. And I can take that, you know, a pretty small scale on some of the like, you know, two or three people teams that I've worked on with, you know, customer facing projects, you know, our kickoff projects. It becomes such a hindrance because you want people to be included and you want them to, you know, participate. And when they don't, it's really hard to figure out how to motivate them and get them up to speed if they just actively don't want to participate in, you know, the virtual meetups, in-person meetups, those kind of conversations. And then, you know, on a bigger scale, when you work with different departments on a bigger project, not having that buy-in in the culture, I think, can be pretty detrimental to a project at the end of the day. I think that there's probably like a balance between what we're currently doing culture-wise and what it used to be. You know, there's a lot of aspects, you know, what you were saying about your neighbor. I miss being in person with the team. I mean, we've been doing things that have definitely helped fulfill some of those gaps. And I think our weekly meetups and the Q Life have been great because I've gotten to learn about a lot of the team members in ways that I never would have, especially for those that are remote and don't live locally to New York City. But there's definitely some part of it that's still missing. I miss, you know, hey, I want to go out for a beer after work or want to grab lunch. You know, certain aspects of that I think are at the end of the day irreplaceable virtually. There's definitely ways to fulfill some of those gaps. But you have to have a willing team to fulfill them. And I think, you know, kind of referencing the first podcast that you did here, I just lost my train of thought. Oh gosh. I lost my train of thought. Your first podcast. It'll come back to me in a minute.
That's okay. But we can give you the last word.
Can we move on to Harvey now? And I'll think about that last point because it was a good one. I'll get back.
Yeah, to before we go to Harvey, I will say that I agree. I think there is like to achieve equilibrium, you have to test both ends, right? And we have you know, people, unfortunately for us, and not just microculture, macroculture, unfortunately people make their mind up about what culture, what normal is supposed to be, and they're unwilling to change until somebody smacks them across the head and says it doesn't always have to be this way. Yeah. Like, there isn't a right or wrong answer to lots of things in life. And I think people, I think some people think the right answer was a regimen to show up every day and do it this way. And that is the path to success. And I'm not saying that's not the case. I'm sure if you want to be Arnold Schwarzenegger, you got to get out of the bed in the morning and drink 12 raw eggs and show up at the gym. Like, I get it. That's a muscle memory sort of thing. But this job we do is not a muscle memory thing. It's the muscle memory is learning to find new muscles. It's not about working the same muscle out that you know about every day. So that requires variety. And that variety is sometimes just sitting at home on conference calls for 12 hours and not commuting 4 hours is just a better way to just a better quality of life. And having someone dictate to you that you need to do it this way because it's how they did it, it kind of, to me, it says a lot about like, it should be hard for you because it was hard for me. And like, that's pretty lame. So I think, I feel like there's a lot of bad that's happening, but hey, it's a smack across the face to let people realize there are lots of businesses that can survive and do things differently. We can get cars off the road. We can ease commutes for people who do have to get to places. We can work with flex time. Like there are businesses that shouldn't be creating, you know, the New York City cycle. There aren't a whole lot of people building things in Manhattan. It shouldn't be a 2-hour wait to get through the Lincoln Tunnel every day. Like, because not most of those people can work virtually all day long every day. And yeah, there are things like fashion and where you need to, like, being there is really important, right? Because it's hard to build a wedding dress virtually. I mean, I'm sure you could do a lot of it, especially if you're subcontracting the stitching. But I think there are things where that at a table collaboration means a lot. By all means, we should give those people a window to get into the city faster. For a lot of the rest of us, getting there at 8 o'clock in the morning is meaningless. Like, we could get there at 11 because honestly, for us, it's often more valuable to leave at 9 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night. So we don't have a lot to do from 8 to 11 o'clock in the morning sitting in the office. So let's just get smarter about how we use what we have from an infrastructure perspective and lots of things. So I do agree though. Like I'm looking forward to the day where I can come into the city when I want to and go out for beers and a happy hour. Harv, how about you?
You guys basically hit the nail on the head. You got me thinking too. Like I hated going to work in the morning because the train over here is to the cities, you're packed like a sardine, it's dirty, people are all coughing. It's like, it's just a dreadful spot. And like to start out your day like that, it's just not good. And like just the culture of being able to adapt, being able to change, especially working from home, I think that just really helped our team a lot. But we've been doing it for a while, but just facing it hard, dead on, it has just helped us evolve and grow a lot more than I thought it would, honestly.
Yeah, I think we may have lost Michelle's audio. She may have to drop and rejoin, or...
And you can't hear me?
Oh, I got you now.
Okay.
All right.
Sorry.
Yeah, I agree, Harv. So I'm looking forward to, I kind of laugh about some of the things that I read about, you know, just, you know, we're going to separate people in the office. Like, honestly, if I had to hang out in a room with you two, a foot apart, I wouldn't really worry. After I ran the gauntlet of New Jersey Transit and the New York City subway system, like exactly. That's the least of my worries is showing up with the people I know in the office. So a lot of it is like, that's the other thing. A lot of it is so geographically dependent. And in this world where we're, you know, we're governing things and leading organizations that are spread out across the planet, like how we need to operate in different geographies at different times, like it's hard to even get a grasp, like, of what that means. Like, if you don't get on the, if you live in Chicago and drive to work every day and park in a parking lot and walk into your office, that's a big delta from going on, sitting on a platform, you know, yeah. New Jersey Transit or PATH or, you know, the MTA, and because that can't be safe. Like, it just can't be. So I don't know. I guess we'll see what happens over time, but I feel like we've all gotten a lot more flexible, in the way we do things. And I think that idea of taking an hour long walk at lunch is a great idea. That's like an empowering thing. And a lot of it's because we're looking more at yield, like people's yield is far more important right now than where people are and what they're doing. Because ultimately, like, it's not as easy as just showing up at an office and going roll call. So to me, I think that's goodness.
Yeah. And you kind of created that culture. I mean, day one with me around, like, as long as, you know, it wasn't about roll call or anything like that coming into the office. So I think that's part of why our adjustment specifically has been probably easier than other, you know, other departments within the company and then other, you know, companies in general. One thing that I think is hard to overcome virtually and working remotely is transparency is maybe not the right word, but if I explain it a little bit, maybe it'll get you on the right track. But I think, like, I'd be sitting in the office sometimes and hearing, you know, someone talk about a customer or talk about something going on with, you know, a certain project that they're working on that I normally wouldn't have heard if I'm sitting in my apartment working remotely. And then that can tap into a conversation like, oh, you know what, I had a similar issue, or, you know what, like, that I didn't even know was going on. How can I help? I can help with that kind of, those kind of conversations, get a little lost virtually. And I think that's maybe where that would be really hard to overcome virtually 100%. You know, I think that those kind of like water cooler conversations that people have, that's something that I think can play a huge role. It's definitely, there's been, I can name like five incidents where it has helped me with projects or I've been able to help someone else with certain scenarios, just like on, you know, eavesdropping essentially on this conversation.
Yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying. I think there is, again, there is a piece of this that some every culture has micro cultures, right? Like, I feel like at least the culture that I is transparent and tries to be inclusive, and like the need for a water cooler conversation to get somebody involved, like, it's, that's, to me, that's, it's great that it happens,
because
my question is always, should there be a need for it to happen? Like, shouldn't you be more intentional and proactive about engage? I mean, this is a business, right? We're here to like maximize our productivity, get the right people involved, expand our opportunity. We're here to do all these things. And if somebody else has to listen, like passively listen to a conversation that they weren't included in order to kind of help somebody else, that's a backwards paradigm. And to me, my concern is, while I look at it, and I think a lot of people look at it and go, this has really taught me how to be more intentional about how to include people in different ways, because now I can't rely on somebody to just like get it in passing. I think for some people, they're like, oh, well, things will be much better when we go back to how it used to be. And my thing was, well, if you adopted to a way it could be really useful now, it would be so much better.
Yeah.
When we get back to where we used to be, because you would have adopted this intentional thought process, you would take it into this social environment where it was easy to tap someone on the shoulder, and things could get better, not return to where they were, but take 6 months of learning and go, wow, this is so much better now because I put in so much more thought into things, and, you know, I had more time to think through things because it was just me and I had to figure out how to rally people around me. And that was, I just I wonder how many people are, how many people we need to like hover the water cooler who were thinking about it that way. And to me, that'd be a sad miss.
Yeah. A good point and a fair rebuttal. And I agree with it.
All right. So in the past 6 months, as we've been sitting at home, what have you learned about yourself? And do you think it's, you know, do you think it's unique or do you think, you know, similar experiences have been had by lots of people that, you know, Michelle, we'll start with you.
I think I'm probably not super unique in the growth I've made in the last couple months. I think I did struggle a lot. I think, you know, a lot of people are social people. I do thrive on interactions with people. So having a lot of like downtime and alone time, it caused me to think in ways that I hadn't in a while or hadn't been forced to in a while. I had a, what you would call it, like a big birthday, like literally 2 weeks before COVID hit, I turned 30. And so then after that, you know, it was, okay, now sit in your apartment for who knows how long. I think I was able to, you know, get more comfortable with that alone time, which I think has benefited me in personal and professional ways, which has been good. But I don't know if it's super unique. I think a lot of people, if you're forced to be on your own, at some point you're either going to sink or swim in your thoughts. And I think at some point it was like, if this is how it's going to be for whoever knows how long, like I can't just sit here like moping around. I like started doing, you know, we had Shelly's boot camp gym in the mornings with my roommates and like my one neighbor that we were quarantining with. You know, we started doing little things, cooking more with, you know, people and you're just spending more time with the people that are in your, you know, in your quarantine, your pod or whatever they're calling it. And you get to know people on a different level and you get to have conversations, you know, see people work. Both my roommates did not stay home. We're not ever home, during the workday. So I got to see them in a different light and understand like a little bit more about their jobs that like you just don't learn in conversations about like, oh, how's your work day today, you know?
Yep.
So that was huge. And then I also got to connect with a lot of family. A lot of my family lives out in Ohio and then my parents live about an hour away. And we started doing like consistent like video calls. It's gotten definitely trailed off a bit more recently, but got to connect with them on a more regular basis. And I think it's kind of been nice to reconnect with certain people in different ways because without having that personal or that in-person interaction, you learn to talk about things in a different way on the phone that you just be like, oh, next time I see you, we'll talk about this kind of conversation. So it's been, you know, an interesting, and I think eventually it was a fun experience.
you think it's something tomorrow, pandemic's over, it's perfectly fine, leave your house, head out to the beer garden, close proximity to lots of other people, like, definitely looking forward to that day, especially when I can go to a baseball game or a football game. Like I really like the sporting situation is abysmal. But the do you think you look back and go, I'm like mentally tougher because of this experience, or do you think you go, hope I never have to live that again, lock the key, throw it away, like just want to forget about it?
No, I definitely think I'm stronger out of it. I think there's certain aspects I never want to see again. I like to go out to eat and like eventually, you know, go to a bar after work and kind of just relax and watch a football game would be nice. I definitely think there's certain aspects of it. I did have some people close to me who, you know, contracted COVID and some serious, you know, results from that, that were pretty traumatizing. So that part, yes, I would like to forget, but I think, I don't know if it's ever going to go back to exactly what it was. I don't think it will. I think there's certain aspects that we've learned to adjust and when, as in general, our society would be better, you know, to keep with.
Yeah. How about you, Harv?
Say the biggest self-discovery, just I guess with me, would just be more honest with myself, just because the whole COVID thing has made us just see who we really are, what we stand for. For example, like, I know it's a small example, but like when you're like texting like some like a friend or something, right? You sometimes just make up like, oh, I'm doing this, but we're all in COVID, we all know where we are. Like you can't lie, you have to be straight up to them. You have to be, oh, I don't want to hang out with you, or you know, something like that. So it's kind of just being making us just be more honest with ourselves. I know for myself too, I've another thing too is like I've been more political. I haven't really been too involved with politics lately, but having this whole COVID thing, seeing how the government's handling things, just seeing people's opinions, just bouncing back with different types of political ideas. I found out where I really stand and what I really want in my country, or what I want to promote and with my peers in my country. So just a lot of just thinking about that we've been just living like a facade, kind of like we've all been like all thinking like everything's all good and nice, but then like something like COVID happens, everybody freaks out, companies go down, like, you know, things are starting to change and such a crazy matter that you really have to focus on like what's really what you want and what do you want to, you know, get out of life, what do you want to do to yourself. I know I was moping around at first when there was no gyms. I was like, oh man, I'm starting to get a little fat, you know, and everything. But then, you know, I was like, you know, fuck, I'm just gonna start working out at home. I started working out a little more, and then now I'm going to the park. So it's just like if you want to do something, you do it no matter what. And just realizing these little small things about myself has just helped me out through COVID.
That's great. Yeah, I think I've just thought a lot about how unbelievably rigid the world is, and I think COVID has been like a magnifying glass on the rigidity of the human spirit. Like we really like there is consistency. Like everyone's comfortable with consistency and predictability. And then there's like, and put my stake in the ground and I don't want any change. And I guess I get so fired up about words like the new normal, because it's like, it seems like a derogatory statement for the unknown. And it's like, come on. Like if we all just accepted the unknown and the fact that stuff will be different tomorrow, the only thing that's consistent is how you conduct yourself. Like, focus on that, not on what the ecosystem around you looks like, and then life will be fine. And I guess to me, it's like this has been a real looking glass for society, right? And then take all the, you know, all the things happening in the world, like the bad things that are happening on a world scale. I don't care whether it's, you know, Black Lives Matter and, you know, things that just shouldn't be happening in this country, or the fact that, you know, somehow the only guy who is anti-Putin gets poisoned and somehow that's not connected to the Russian regime. I don't really know how people say these things with a straight face, right? Like it'd be so much more refreshing if somebody just got up and went, of course it's connected. Like, of course it's connected. And of course it's a dictatorship. And you probably shouldn't speak out because you're probably going to die. That would be refreshing to me because it would be real. And then you could figure out how you could change it. And the other day I was having a conversation about, you know, realistically, like, historically, you kind of wonder, like, there's only really been two modes of changing the world, whether it's political or anything else, where you either have revolution or you succumb to a dictatorship. Like, those are the two things, right? So revolution is almost an impossibility today. And as we finish up with the convergence of tech and culture, like, tech has made revolution impossible. Because there is no cloak of darkness. Once the machine is moving, and you're in the surveillance state, you can't get enough groundswell to have a revolution, because everyone knows what you're doing when you're doing it. And to me, that's the scary part. It's ultimately we've subscribed to a control model. And if we want to change it, it's going to have to be an interesting grassroots effort, because by the time you try to get the word out, it's almost like it's known, and the propaganda is coming over the top trying to swing it back. And it's the like the pearl of progress, I guess. But on a scale that I don't know we've ever seen before, right? Like super happy we have Zoom and Skype and Teams and WebEx, because imagine what pandemic would be like without it.
Yeah.
At the same time, somebody's running natural language processing on this Skype call, and I'm probably on some radar now because I had a comment about, you know, Putin. That's been flagged somewhere. I believe it's probably true. Like, but it'll be interesting to see how we move forward. Anyway, that I think that just about does it. I really appreciate you guys joining me on the call today. I think we covered some good topics, and we're at our 1 hour mark. And if you guys have any final comments, I'll let you make them. Michelle, any final comments?
No, this was great. I appreciated the invite, and I appreciated the conversation. It was nice. So thank you for the invite.
You're welcome. How about you, Harv?
Yeah, I was a little nervous at first, and I'm not really good at like talking about these type of things, but just talking to you guys, I felt like you guys really know a lot of things, so I was able to bounce back ideas, and I really appreciate the chances to talk about this. So.
Yeah, it was a good dialogue, and that's the whole point of this, is just to have good dialogue, right? Share our thoughts with the broader community of our five listeners. We'll grow that over time.
Pretty much are on this call.
You're up at 20 views.
Remember to like your own podcast. Yeah. All right. Thanks, Michelle. Thanks, Harvey.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye. Bye.